RN. It's hello from David Rutledge and welcome to Earshot. Great to have your company. Today, we're all about the water, both as a medium for leisure activities and as a battlefield in war. A little later in this hour, we'll be going fishing. But first up, we hear the story of a father's near death in Australian waters during World War II, told by his daughter. It's about a war that raged off the east coast of Australia, although a lot of people don't know anything about it, when commercial shipping crews of the Merchant Navy were as much at risk as the warships of the regular Royal Australian Navy. Keith Roy Smith was deck boy on a BHP ship that was sunk near Bermagui on the New South Wales south coast in 1943. Kerry Stewart is his daughter, and she produced this program.
Well, it was about 12 in the morning, and this great explosion. And the other deck boy, he was sleeping up above me, and I said, "Come on, we're hit." I woke him up, and up we go up to the boat deck.
The deck boy John Stone woke up was my 17-year-old dad, Keith Smith. He grabbed a life jacket, scrambled up to the deck and jumped over the side of the Iron Knight. These are a couple of written accounts by other survivors.
I reached the deck as the ship started to list. The stern of the ship was right out of the water and the propeller was racing in mid-air. The bosun shouted, "The boats, boys!" Subsequently, the ship lurched forward by 10 feet. I sang out to the boys, "It's the water or your life! Make for the water!" Jumped into the water when the ship was at an angle of 45 degrees and were eventually picked up by one of the rafts. Ernest Johnston.
I've never been able to swim a stroke. I thought I'd gone for good when the ship went down under my feet. Last time I was torpedoed was last year. No matter how I struggled in the water, something seemed to be drawing me down. And suddenly this suction stopped and I shot to the surface. We had a pretty rotten time being tossed around out there. We cheered like hell when we saw a ship coming towards us. Jay Wilkins, Chief Cook.
The Iron Knight, a BHP ship, was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine off the east coast of Australia on the 8th of February 1943. Only 14 of a crew of 50 survived. I've always wondered why a merchant ship was sunk so close to home. Was it just bad luck or something more? When my dad was alive, he didn't talk much about the sinking, and there isn't an official history of Australian merchant seamen's contribution to World War II. But I've uncovered, through the window of my dad's experience, an untold story of commitment and loss involving thousands of men and their families that played out on our coastline.
For them, no glory, no triumphant headland.
This film, called For Them, No Glory, was made in 1944.
But they are fighting the most vital and incessant battles of this war. Their comings and goings are unheralded. Their convoys attacked, broken, forced to scatter. But sooner or later they turn up at the ports to which their cargoes are consigned. We owe much to these quiet men.
Deck Boy Smith would have been down at the after end, the poop. Everybody that managed to survive came from the after section of the ship. We're looking at the wonderful builder's model of the Iron Knight, which was sunk off Montague Island. We're in Newcastle, and we're at the Newcastle Maritime Museum. My name's Ian Stevenson. I was Marine Superintendent for the BHP shipping fleet till 1991. I've had a particular interest in shipping all my life, and especially in relation to the effect that the Australian Merchant Navy had on the war effort in the World War II. It's an effort that is not acknowledged generally, which is sad, and it's a story that should be better known.
So ships of all descriptions, old and new, large and small, oil burners and coal burners, steam steadily out of port, bows down and propellers thrashing, bound for the unknown and manned by those quiet casual fellows, the men of the Merchant Navy.
So the captain on this model, there's the bridge, his quarters would have been below the bridge. So he didn't survive?
No, the explosion was in the way of the hatch just forward of the bridge, number two hatch, and that whole area would have been destroyed with the explosion. And when the ship broke in half, the forepart went down first and would have taken the accommodation, but it all happened so quickly, and with the heavy iron ore cargo, it's like throwing a stone into the water. It just would have gone straight down.
They were called death ships, weren't they, because they went down so fast?
That's correct. They were very lucky. The Iron Knight sank in 2 minutes. It was torpedoed by the Japanese submarine at 2:30 in the morning. The few survivors that managed to get off, you could describe as being extremely lucky.
Here on the foreshore of Newcastle Harbour, there's a memorial. The plaque that names those merchant seamen lost on the Iron Knight and the Iron Crown was originally unveiled at the BHP Steelworks in the 1950s and moved here a couple of years ago. SS Iron Knight, 8th of February 1943. D. Ross, Master, and the following officers and their crew. Anderson, R.F., Bedford, E., Burns, L.
In all, 30 merchant ships were lost by enemy attack in Australian waters, with 654 deaths. And about 200 of those were thought to be Australian merchant seamen. But these figures are very hard to be definite about, because there were merchant seamen from different countries in Australian waters, merchant ships from other countries. Australian merchant seamen went overseas. They went from ship to ship. Some were in ships in the Atlantic convoys and some were in the Mediterranean. So we don't really know exactly how many there were. I'm Patricia Miles. I was a curator at the National Maritime Museum in Sydney for 22 years before I retired a few years ago. My father was a merchant seaman who was at sea in Australian waters during World War II.
Was he ever sunk?
No, he was lucky, but he lost friends, he lost shipmates and ships which he'd been in.
Iredale, K. Johannesson, H.
Now, my name is Ken Iredale, Kenneth Iredale, and I had my dad's name, which is Kenneth Iredale. We lived in Stockton. It's a suburb of Newcastle, and we've lived there... The Iredale name is synonymous to Stockton. He came out through the ships as a deck boy, and then when he passed away, he was an AB, an able-bodied seaman. When he was drowned, he was, I think, 22. He had two children, my sister Dawn and myself. When he did pass away, I was only 3 months old, and my sister was about 18 months old. So really, I didn't know much of him at all growing up. Mum never spoke much about my father. She was remarried about 7 years after his death, but from then on, yeah, we didn't talk about Dad much at all. We just knew that he was on the Iron Knight, a BHP ship, and he passed away when it was sunk down the south coast.
Newcastle had always been a major worldwide port. With the steelworks, which at that stage, Newcastle was, I think, probably the major steelworks in Australia, it was very much an industrial town with all the various industries that were feeding off the steelworks. It had ship repair, it had dry docks, every berth and town had a ship on it. It was really a seafarer's city.
Keith Smith, my father, joined the Merchant Navy on the 20th of October 1942, the day after his 16th birthday. He didn't have much of an education, but could turn his hand to anything practical. Like many young men at the time, Dad worked his way up from a deck boy to an able-bodied seaman. I always thought the torpedoing of the Iron Knight was a one-off event, but I was wrong.
At the beginning of the war, the Germans laid several minefields along the east and south coasts of Australia, and the first two casualties of the war were from German mines. The mines were cleared, but not before they got to small ships off the New South Wales coast.
German raiders were active in the Australian and New Zealand waters at the time, and raiders, which were merchant ships, similar to the ship that sank HMAS Sydney, laid mines, were heavily armed, And, of course, the locals didn't really know where they were or how they could counteract them, but eventually they moved away once Japan came into the war.
But on the whole, it was Japanese submarines which were the menace. During December 1941, the Japanese swept down. They bombed Pearl Harbor in February. They bombed Darwin and northern ports in Australia. They were sweeping down into the Pacific, and it looked as if they were going to overrun Australia.
The Japanese command sent their submarines down in groups. They would come down and they would spend a month or so patrolling off the east coast, and then they would return to their base in the Marshall Islands. There would be a break, and then they would send another group down. It was not a continuous exercise, which really, if it had been, would have spelt disaster for Australia.
The worst times for Japanese attack on Australian merchant ships were 1942 and 1943. 1942, they even got three midget submarines into Sydney Harbour.
The Japanese submarines briefly bombarded Sydney and Newcastle.
It was a Sunday night when they shelled us. We were shelled from a submarine, and the shells were going right over our house, and some landed in the street, broke all the Venetian blinds on a block of flats a block away from us, blew the leaves off the trees.
So did people feel frightened by that? I mean, how did the community respond to Newcastle Harbour being attacked?
Well, I think it brought home to people on the east coast that, together with the mini-submarine attack in Sydney, which was just before, that the war was actually on their doorstep. The Japanese obviously used it as an exercise in destabilising the locals. And friends of mine, young people, young school kids, their parents packed them off to inland New South Wales.
In mid-1942, there were a series of losses. On the 3rd of June, Iron Chieftain was sunk with 12 dead. And the next day, Iron Crown was sunk with 38 lives lost. After this, the convoy system was set up, which did have the advantage that people who survived sinkings were saved, but they also made the voyages slow and cumbersome and presented themselves as targets. The naval vessels escorting them were not really very able to protect them.
And in the case of the Iron Knight, it was one of 10 ships. They were in single line, one behind the other, with a spacing in between the lines, and the two naval ships were in support on the outside of the convoy. The Iron Knight itself was the lead ship on the outer line, and outside of it was HMAS Townsville. And in the case of the Iron Knight, when the submarine fired the torpedo, it actually went under the Townsville and straight into the deeply loaded Iron Knight.
Ian Stevenson at the Newcastle Maritime Centre. Dad told me that he jumped over the side of the ship with a life jacket, but then gave it to someone else who was struggling in the water. He'd learned to swim in the Scouts and was a strapping 17-year-old. But that didn't stop him from worrying as he floated around in the dark water about sharks and the Japanese sub rising to the surface to finish them off.
They were rescued by the Free French destroyer, the Le Triomphant, which left Sydney at 5:36 in the morning and arrived on the scene at 11 o'clock that morning.
So why was the Merchant Navy important in the war? What did they do that was important?
The Merchant Navy was vital, and they were prime targets for Japanese attack because they were carrying supplies to troops up in the islands. They were carrying materials for shipbuilding, for munitions, for all the things that would keep the country going during the war.
All the Australian shipping companies were somehow involved in the war effort. The passenger ships became hospital ships. In the case of the Taroon, owned by the Union Company of New Zealand, it was the ship that ferried a large proportion of the troops to Port Moresby. They were heavily involved. Every ship was involved.
So they weren't just unlucky, these merchant ships. They were, it was actually planned to target them?
Oh, no, they were targeted. They were definitely targeted. In fact, many Japanese and German officers were told to avoid engaging with naval ships at all costs because it was the merchant ships that they wanted to knock out. And merchant ships were very ill-equipped to withstand this because, they, in general, they were coal-burning, not oil-burning like naval ships, which meant that they were very visible by day because of the plume of smoke and by night because of the trail of embers. Also, they often had only anti-aircraft guns, which were no use at all against torpedoes, against submarines. Their crews were smaller than naval crews and they were not trained for warfare. And naval ships had watertight compartments and armour plating on them, whereas the merchant ships didn't. So the merchant ships were very, very vulnerable.
None know better than they of the hazards they run, but they treat them lightly. But it is their heritage to go down to the sea in ships. Their work started on the first day of the war and will continue night and day until it is all over.
If a ship was hit, the direction was for the rest of the convoy to maintain speed. The Navy ships, I think, had a sweep around to see whether there were survivors, but their main concern was the submarine and protecting the remaining ships in the convoy. Talking to people and reading the stories, certainly the Australian coastal fleet, it was an open lottery whether you were actually going to survive. They worked hard. They were always concerned about the submarine menace, but that was part of the deal. Seafarers just put up with it and basically get on with the job.
I thought Dad walked away from the Merchant Navy after the sinking of the Iron Knight in 1943. It was only when I received his service record from the National Archives that I discovered he went back to sea and worked on many ships throughout the course of the war. It wasn't until 1949 that Dad gave up a life at sea, 6 months before marrying my mother, Colleen.
One reason that what was happening with merchant seamen was not well known was the wartime secrecy. Because if a ship was sunk, they wouldn't say the Iron Chieftain was sunk this afternoon. They would say there were four sinkings off the coast, a British freighter of so-and-so tons and two Australian merchant ships. And that was the sort of detail they gave. But at the same time, there were human interest interviews. So we have little snippets of information from sources like the Women's Weekly or the Daily Telegraph.
Patricia Miles. When the survivors of the Iron Knight landed ashore, the Newcastle Herald did some interviews and took a photo of them on the wharf. Going through Dad's albums, I found the original of that black and white photo and a couple of others that were taken illegally by someone on Le Triomphant. There's a grainy image of the 14 men as they boarded the ship, exhausted and almost naked. They were given French Navy uniforms, shorts and the classic blue and white striped tops. Interestingly, the photo of them used in the Newcastle Herald in 1943 was slightly different to the original. The men's tops were white with no stripes, presumably to adhere to secrecy laws.
With simple, steadfast courage, these men faced the unknown.
You're listening to Earshot on RN.
Prayer to the swift savagery of a ruthless enemy.
When a ship was sunk, the merchant seamen's pay stopped the day that the ship went down. There may have been individual ship owners who paid compensation or helped, but they were not entitled to anything when their ship went down.
Immediately after your dad died, what happened? Was there any payment or anything like that?
I believe BHP, as soon as the ship went down, but people don't work for BHP anymore. That's how it was in those days. But the BHP were pretty good in so much as that they, I think they gave Mum about £250 just as a lump sum payment. Then she had to get, I think, the pension from the government to keep her going because she had two small children. When Dad was there, we lived together, but then when he passed away, we ended up getting the commission house, and we had in the commission house, we had my mum's father and mother living with us, my mum's sister living with us, and her brother as well living with us.
The survivors, after they were sunk, had to look out for themselves and they had to find themselves another job at sea. They had 30 days survivor's leave, which might include some of the time they spent on a life raft, which was not paid leave. Many people thought at the time that merchant seamen were well compensated for their war service by the war risk bonuses which they were awarded, which progressively increased by union action throughout the war.
Merchant Navy veterans and their widows weren't covered by the same Pensions Act as Royal Australian Naval personnel. The situation of merchant mariners didn't really improve until 1989, when there was an inquiry by the Repatriation Commission that revealed many inequities.
The inquiry by the Repatriation Commission concluded that merchant seamen probably ended up about equal financially to their naval counterparts when naval conditions of pay and taxation and so forth were taken into account. But the Repatriation Commissioner, Jocelyn McGurr, pointed out that all merchant seamen, by virtue of their jobs, were at risk all the time. While members of the Navy quite often went for all of the war or part of the war at home bases without ever being in harm's way. Sometimes never even served in a theatre of war.
In 1941, as the war escalated, Australian and Allied merchant ships were requisitioned by the Shipping Control Board. The Fingal was a Norwegian merchant ship under charter to the Australian government, sailing from Sydney to Darwin with general cargo and ammunition. On the 5th of May 1943, two Japanese torpedoes, one after the other, smashed into the ship when it was off Nambucca Heads on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. It went down within a minute, and only 18 survived. John Bird was a 15-year-old deck boy.
I still remember it clearly, up until the second torpedo explosion, when I sailed up into the air, landing on top of cargo on the already ripped open hatch, and having one leg caught under cargo, everything blacked out. I thought to myself at the time that if this is dying, it's quite easy. An elderly Norwegian seaman apparently came across me, and as I was wearing a life jacket, he picked me up and dropped me over the side of the ship, which by this time was almost underwater. I came to in the water with another seaman slapping my face as I mumbled something about swimming to shore.
All survivors were thickly coated with black fuel oil and suffered from prolonged chilling. Many were clothed only in skimpy underwear or skivvies and suffered from hypothermia and long immersion. Practically every survivor was extremely ill from the ingested oil, and to the last man, all vomited large quantities of fuel oil, carrots and green peas during the rescue efforts. The survivors were examined and treated on board the USS Patterson, given a cup of pea soup and put to bed. The next morning they landed at Newcastle, where the injured were taken to hospital by ambulances. Dr. Henry W. Moore, USS Patterson.
My pay stopped the hour and the minute that the Fingal was sunk. I'd lost all my clothes and possessions, and I didn't even have my fare for the train to get home to Bexley from Newcastle. Unlike other services who were re-kitted and provided with transport and leave to go home, merchant seamen were on their own. Bernie O'Brien, deck boy.
When they were taken ashore at King's Wharf in Newcastle, they were taken across the road to, I think it was the CWA, had set up a post to look after them. But Bernie O'Brien, who was on that ship, he became quite sick with, as it turned out, he had pneumonia and he'd suffered from exposure. And a Norwegian seaman picked him up and carried him up the road to Newcastle Hospital. But the touching little story about that is that as they were going up the hill, some women thought they were drunk and stuck a white feather in the coat of the seaman who was carrying Bernie. And that, I think, is a little reflection of why merchant seamen were never really recognised. Only the officers wear uniform and they don't wear it ashore. So they're not conspicuous in the community. And there was nobody to represent. the Merchant Navy, because it's not actually one institution like the Royal Australian Navy. It's a collection of ships owned by different ship owners. And no one knew of their service, except those people who had relatives along the coast and those people in their little towns along the coast where the merchant seamen landed up came staggering off boats.
Finally, in 1990, a memorial dedicated to Australian merchant mariners was placed on the foreshore of Lake Burley Griffin in Canberra.
It's no wonder when you look at the 22-volume official war history produced by the Australian War Memorial, you find in the two volumes that are devoted to the Navy, there's one page devoted to the Merchant Navy, and only where it's incidental to the Royal Australian Navy story. So it's no surprise that people don't know much about it when even the official war history doesn't really cover it.
In 2006, Ken Iredale and some other family members of the men lost on the Iron Knight got reports from a dive team and the Heritage Office that the ship had been found off Bermagui. They travelled from Newcastle to the south coast of New South Wales for a ceremony and placed 36 poppies, one for each seaman, in the water over the wreck. Sadly, after a few years, it was discovered that it wasn't the resting place of the Iron Knight and the many fathers and sons that went down with her.
It was very, very disappointing, very emotional. We come back on board from the ship to the Bermagui shore, and I was sitting with the sister, and she said, now I've found Dad, I don't want to leave him now. But unfortunately, it wasn't our ship. My dad, you know, he was my dad, even though I respected my stepfather. He was my dad, so I thought, you know, I had to show respect for him. I'm not the only one that's had lost their dad, so there's a lot of people out there and a lot of Merchant Navy people that would be in the same boat.
I was really lucky to have my dad by my side when I was growing up. When I was young, my parents bought a boat shed on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, where Dad spent many happy years working with wooden boats and looking out to sea.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take my arms, I'll never use your goodbye left me with eyes that cry. How can I go on, dear, without you? You took the part that once was my heart, so why not take all of me?
RN's Earshot, you've been listening to Dad's Navy, produced by Kerry Stewart with sound engineer Phil McKellar. And over on the RN website, you'll find an article about Merchant Seamen's contribution to World War II and some wonderful archival photos of the survivors of the Iron Knight. And if a member of your family or a workmate was engaged in this conflict, we'd love to hear from you. You can make an online comment or join the Earshot conversations on Facebook and Twitter. And on RN, this is David Rutledge. Up next on Earshot, we're going fishing.
Earshot. Meet the world with your ears.
Now, I don't know about you, but I'm what you might call a fair weather fisherman. I like catching fish. I certainly like eating fish. But when it comes to sitting around or standing around waiting for fish to bite, I don't quite have the Zen mentality for it. At least that's how I felt before I heard this next story, which has got me reconsidering the whole thing. From producer Justine Sloan-Lees, this is The Complete Angler.
So I started in my 20s having never fished, and Tom Gleisner, who I've worked with for 30 years, said he knew of a lake hidden in the bush, maybe an hour and a half out of Melbourne, and would I come along and do a bit of spin fishing. So it was really more to go for the drive and have a chat. And I caught one, and we spent the day there, and it was instantly addictive.
Beginner's luck.
And I just thought it was one of the most beautiful places on earth. And then I think I discovered the mountain streams, the Great Divide of New South Wales and Victoria, and then New Zealand, and that was sort of the escalation.
I started fishing, I think, probably when a bunch of blokes lived out at Patterson Lakes, and we had boats and we decided to fish. A lot of time to spare, and fishing sort of filled in that time. From there it just kept growing, more and more passion towards it. I found it became a way of switching off from work and life, and everything was just, by the time you decided you were going fishing, your mind switched off from everything but going fishing, and I found that really relaxing. I live here because I find the water calming. My life's basically built around the water. Everything I do, all our relaxation time, even walking the dogs, it's always down the beach. I have my lunch down on the water every day. I leave the job site, I come down to the water. It's a relaxing, and it's a place I can switch off. There's nothing else to think about. You're looking at the water, you're looking at the landscape, everything's just beautiful.
So part of it's about being outside.
Look, it's outside, and then it's the there's a reflective quality to it. There's a very, very famous book, was a novella called A River Runs Through It, and became a famous film. And at the end of that film, Robert Redford reads the final paragraph. I think every fly fisherman in the world knows it. And he finishes an emotional reflection on failing to understand his family. And it ends like this. He says, "Eventually all things merge into one and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I'm haunted by waters." Now, I've read that 1,000 times and I still don't have a clue what it means. But the final sentence, "I'm haunted by waters," every single fly fisherman knows what that means. There's something when you spend a lot of time in the mountains that you've, I think, unconsciously conflated introspection and reflection on life with the inability to bottle and capture that feeling that you have. And there's something about, in your mind, you associate rivers with a failure to fully understand your own life. And the word haunted, I think, is the only word I do understand.
I waded deepening into the dark water. Evening in the push and swirl of the river as it closed around my legs and held on. Young grilse broke water. Par darted one way, smolt another. Gravel turned under my boots as I edged out. Watched by the furious eyes of king salmon, their immense heads turned slowly, eyes burning with fury as they hung in the deep current. They were there. I felt them there, and my skin prickled. But there was something else. I braced with the wind on my neck, felt the hair rise as something touched my boot, grew afraid of what I couldn't see, then of everything that filled my eyes. That other shore, heavy with branches, the dark lip of the mountain range behind, and this river that had suddenly grown black and swift. I drew breath and cast anyway, prayed nothing would strike. The River, Raymond Carver.
So it's not so important whether or not you actually catch anything.
No. So there's a scale, I think, of emotion. I think when you start the day, one of the reasons I like reading prose and poetry about fishing is that generally everyone sort of distills down to the same emotions and feelings. You start the day going, I better damn well catch a fish. And if you catch a few, you go, you know what, it's not about catching fish. And if you don't catch a fish, you still say it's not about catching fish, but on the drive back, you kind of go, yeah, but I reckon it's still about catching one or two.
Do you feel like there's a battle of wills between you and the fish?
There is a battle of wills between you. It's trout, and I think this is why trout seem to... Well, it's got the brain the size of a pea, and you know that it's not really a fair fight, since, I don't know, what's a human brain? 2 or 3 kilos? And somehow they're outwitting you, and so that's a frustration too. But they tend to inhabit beautiful waters. In places like New Zealand, you get to see them, so you every stalker, hunter instinct in you is ignited, you know. But they're designed to outwit. And that just is a frustration mixed with joy and, you know, it's very primitive.
I'm interested, though, is there some way in which going fishing is a legitimate way to get away from the wife and kids sometimes?
Absolutely. Again, it's my way of having my time. The pressures of being a parent, a father, a provider, to get away and, again, not to think about anything else but me and what I'm doing is a massive part of it.
But then, you, as you just said, husband, father, provider, you're bringing home the fish.
Yeah, always. My family eat fish regularly, a couple of times a week, which means I've got to go out and catch it, which is, you know, a terrible thing.
Summertime, and the living is here.
A breeze nudges the empty aluminium boat as it drifts at the end of its rope. Its lightness wallowing within it like a fat man who has fished all day and fallen asleep and is dreaming of when he was a little boy and weighed no more than a plastic bucket. Years of floating alone, fishing far from the tourist cabins shining like rivets along the water's edge, have bleached the blue from his overalls and denim shirt. His face has the flat grey sheen of a man with a failing heart. But he is all lightness now, and tethered only gently to this world. Bank fishing for bluegills, Ted Cooser.
Fishing with my stepson, Robert Adamson. We wake by your watch on my wrist. Its piercing silicon chip alarm, bat squealing, needling through our room in the angler's rest. We drink Coke from a plastic esky, with ice melting into newspaper-wrapped squid, the only unfrozen bait in town. In perfect dawn, we set out from Don's boats. The outboard ploughs us through a bay. At Juno Point, we cast out silver tobies, our new Swedish lures. Your pure graphite rod flashes in first light. Your graceful cast sails out fine as spiderweb. The smooth water mirrors the arc. A year passes, and the minute it takes for you to reel in your first true catch, the rod bending, line singing, realizing strike, and the flash of fish fire. The final buck underwater dash of a school jewfish, its explosion in air, and for that split second of communion between us. Utter wonder.
Is it a battle of will between you and the fish?
Oh, definitely. It's definitely a personal battle between the two of you. You spend hours with each other. It's not something you catch within 5 minutes. You're actually fishing on them for 3 or 4 hours. And it's just a battle of will. It's so many things can go wrong on our end and so many things can go right on their end. Keeping tension on the line, it's a really hard fought battle. And as I said, they use every advantage they have, which is their size and their strength, and we have very few things we can use against them. It's more we try to stay connected to them until they give up and up to us.
Speaking of equipment, it seems to me sometimes fishing is a way for people to acquire lots of gadgets and toys, including motorboats.
Yeah, it's not a cheap hobby. It's very much a boy's toys thing. I like expensive gear because I know when I do get that fish, it's not going to fail on me.
I think gadgets and gear is a really underestimated factor in a male's life, and that's the background of the shed. It's people are constantly trying to explain the current craze in bicycles.
Mm.
And I go, you know, look at the gear. And sort of people gave up running when they discovered bicycles. And I think the graph is linear with gear. And, you know, in that old game of rock beats scissors, is gear beats no gear. The fly fishing reel is one of the most simple gadgets ever. You know, Thomas Edison didn't spend any time on the fly fishing reel. It's, in fact, in a lot of places in the world, they tie a line around a can. And they're not hard to find.
Now, the reel may be simple, but flies are another matter.
So there's a difficulty. It's a bit like the golf swing, is that you use all the big muscles of the body in order to precisely deliver that little bit of metal at the end of the club. And fly fishing's the same. You've got to use all of that coordination in order to deliver something that must be half a gram in weight. And for the fish, you know, they don't have a big brain, but most of it's devoted to spotting fakes. And so it's another passion that people spend a lifetime trying to properly imitate the correct silhouette of a insect on the water.
At a particular time of year.
Right. And so in the mountains, they're often not fussy, and that's probably why I go there. But there's parts of America where, you know, that's a storied history.
From a River Runs Through It, Norman MacLean. It is not in the book, yet it is human enough to spend a moment before casting in trying to imagine what the fish is thinking, even if one of its eggs is as big as its brain, and even if, when you swim underwater, it is hard to imagine that a fish has anything to think about. Still, I could never be talked into believing that all a fish knows is hunger and fear. I have tried to feel nothing but hunger and fear, and don't see how a fish could ever grow to 6 inches if that were all he ever felt. In fact, I go so far sometimes as to imagine that a fish thinks pretty thoughts.
Tell us your one that got away story.
It was actually one that got away from Tom Gleisner, I fished with. We're on a famous river in the north of New Zealand where every pool has a name. And I don't normally fish in that world. It's you go and stand in one pool and the big fish go up and spawn. They're big. They come out of the lake. And I saw one that he had on, and I think it was over 15 pounds. I mean, that's like a small child. And I just remember, and it got off. And he came down and goes, maybe he said, maybe it wasn't that big. And I still had the look of, my God, that was almost 20 pounds.
The one that got away.
The one that got away. We were 50 kilometres offshore at Portland chasing southern bluefin tuna. We were onto a school of 50-pound tuna. We had caught them. We had them around the boat. They were all free swimming around the boat when up came a fish that would probably eat one of them for breakfast. It was at least 200 pounds and 8 foot long, 3-4 foot across the shoulders. It was just, seeing it in the water just looked like a Volkswagen. We continued to troll around and we hooked onto it and we couldn't stop it. And through angler error, we drove over our line and we lost it. But we never got to see it, but we're pretty sure we knew what it was. It was my blue whale.
One of my favourite writers in all of fishing, probably the favourite, is Brian Turner, who's a New Zealand poet, writer, biographer. He wrote of a river in New Zealand that didn't have a great reputation, and I wasn't planning on fishing it until I saw this sentence. He said, "On a fine day, a few hours wandering the grassy flats in the reefs is a tonic. Cicadas and larks sing in high summer, and the views of the great peak Earnslaw to the west, and that the snowfields above the beech forest cloaking the lower slopes of the mountain at the head of the valley are utterly splendid. And I saw that paragraph and I go, that's worth a day. It's exactly as he wrote it. There's an Australian author called Philip Weigel. Again, I once, with Tom, I went up into the upper snowy mountains. So it's above 4,000 feet. It's very fickle weather. They're wilderness areas, and so you can't just drive your car up. You have to walk
very
in.
Very remote.
Yeah, and so you start, and you think, oh, this is a great idea. And 10 kilometres later, you go, wow, I've got to get out of here. And he describes the feeling at the end of the day when you start doing an audit of whether it was worthwhile. Eventually, your burning knees, blistered feet and gasping lungs deliver you back to the car, which you've never been so glad to see. You drop to the ground, swigging the half bottle of lukewarm flat Coke you left on the back seats as if it was the elixir of life, and then you vow never to fish that stream again. So what if the fishing was great? Nothing's worth a walk like that. But the mind works in strange ways, and after an hour in an air-conditioned car and a whole bottle of icy lemonade from the milk bar in Corryong, the memory of the walkout is already being swamped by happier thoughts. It caught my eye because we bought a bottle of soft drink from the same milk bar at Corryong. It's funny, though. It's funny pastimes that produce literature and prose and poetry. And I don't think there's a great canon of literature about squash. You know, a squash court's the same all over the world. You know, tennis maybe has one or two. But fishing seems to have... I don't know a fly fisherman who doesn't have a library. And I think that everyone chases the same elusive thing, and that is, I had this feeling once, and I can't quite describe it. And someone has done it before you. And so I think that people treasure their library, because I think in some ways it's a receptacle for feelings that you probably will forget how to describe. Mm.
Fishing, living, flying, writing. Kevin Brophy. On weekends, the fishermen come down here with enough equipment to keep them busy all day. They are rugged against the weather, and they know about bait. Their lines go in, threads stretching down into the dark, for they are hoping to hook something new this time. Rabbits watch them from the longer tufts of grass. Foxes are sleeping, and the birds do their invisible writing in the sky above, like poets who think they know it all and just need to make quick, enigmatic notes on blue paper, sometimes on grey or cream paper, then flit off to the next topic. Sometimes a pair of swans on the water will glide by the fishermen, showing them another way to be with water. The fishermen hunch down inside themselves then, so that they are dark lumps of consciousness by the water's edge, reduced to thinking about life, bait, and cups of tea, hoping to be visited by a vision or a fish. Instead, they are visited by time, which always arrives at the end of the day. The birds are writing about this as it happens, sometimes before it happens, for they know how the story goes. They are poets.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys, you're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing instead of just a wishing. Oh, yeah.
The Complete Angler, that was produced by Justine Sloan-Lees, and her two passionate fishermen there were comedian and writer Rob Sitch and builder David Higginbotham. Readings were by Fiona McLeod and Simon Maiden, and the studio engineer was Angie Grant. And I'm David Rutledge. That's it from me. I'm going fishing now. Join me on Earshot tomorrow with a portrait of an Australian music pioneer, Martin Wesley Smith, an early proponent of electronic music in Australia, whose life has been marked by a close engagement with art and politics. That's Earshot, and you can catch it tomorrow at 11 o'clock here on RN. Bye for now.